Some voices in this podcast were generated by AI for additional diversity. Rest assured, everything has been translated, edited, and voiced by humans for quality assurance. Enjoy the show.
No one was sleeping in Chonhar at 3 a.m. on the 24th of February, 2022. Since the evening prior, the soldiers of the 137th Separate Marine Battalion, assigned to guard the administrative border with occupied Crimea, had the feeling that war was on the horizon.
On the 23rd, there were already some movements by Russians on the peninsula. Everyone was waiting, and we were a bundle of nerves. Nobody went to bed. Maybe they just napped a bit.
Ivan Sestrivatovsky recollects in an interview with Ukrainska Pravda. The 48-year-old Marine was on duty on the border with Crimea on the night of Russia's invasion, and he was entrusted with one of the most important tasks, blowing up the bridges across the Chonhar Strait that connected Crimea with mainland Ukraine.
We were woken up at around 3 a.m. Everyone was in position. The commander, the senior officer already stationed there, and I went to wire up the devices to blow up the bridges. I stayed behind, and he was in charge of managing the personnel. Everything began with mortar shelling from Crimea. They struck our positions and those of the border guards. The order to blow the bridges was to be given to me directly by the commander, and he, in turn, was to receive an order from the senior leadership. The sappers developed a special plan. There were envelopes that would be opened if necessary, and those envelopes contained instructions for connecting the explosive devices. We ran the necessary wires, and I would be the one to trigger the detonator. There was no communication, as our radios didn't work. The commander was running from one position to another to give orders. Explosives were already detonating. It was very loud, and I struggled to hear anyone. So I jumped the gun and personally made the decision to blow up the bridges. Or at least, I tried to, but there was no explosion. I'm not a sapper myself, but there are two possible explanations. Either a sabotage group had already found and deactivated the explosives, or the detonation wires had been damaged by mortar strikes. I tried to reconnect the charge, reconnect it, and try again. I did this three times, but there was no explosion.
Sestrivatovsky had no choice but to try to catch up with his unit in an old civilian car, but after a few hours of chasing, he was captured by the Russians, the same ones who would cross the intact bridges in Chonhar and flood the Kherson steppes with their convoys of heavy armored equipment in a matter of hours. This is the fourth episode of Ukrainska Pravda's podcast 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, in which we try to recreate the military events of the first day of Russia's full-scale invasion, how the fronts emerged and moved, who heroically stopped the Russians' advance and how they did so, and how Ukrainian cities and the country as a whole recovered from the initial shock and prepared for defensive operations. At 4 a.m. on the 24th of February, there were still shaky hopes that a full-scale war would not break out. In an interview with Ukrainska Pravda, Major General Andriy Sokolov, who has been the commander of the Southern Group of Forces since October 2021 and covered the Crimean front, recalls the moment that last glimmer of hope was dashed at his headquarters that morning.
On the first day of the war, I was at my command post in front of the monitor with a Virage tablet open. This is a program which tracks the flights of all of the aircraft around you. We were there with the head of air defense, the operative on duty. First, at about 4 to 5 a.m., we saw a massive number of aircraft take off in Crimea. We tried to count them, but lost count after 30. They circled over the territory of Crimea at first. There was still hope that they would just fly around and then land back at their bases, since this wasn't the first time this had happened. But they flew in various directions over the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea and launched a massive volley of missiles, First, missile attacks were launched at almost all the sites of our units, our command posts, our starting positions, and our air defense command posts, as well as at the air base of Melitopol. Almost every facility located in Kherson and Zaporizhia oblasts was attacked.
On that dark morning of the 24th of February, there was no longer any room for wishful thinking.
The intelligence was very clear that Putin was planning something stupid.
Boris Johnson, who was Prime Minister of the United Kingdom in February 2022, recounts in a conversation with Ukrainska Pravda.
And by the time February the 23rd came round, you know, that we were intercepting, I'm sure this is no secret now, we were intercepting a lot of signals, a lot of chat that was clearly Russian commanders telling their people, the battalion tactical groups, move forward to your positions. And this was even before the 23rd. So it was clear that something appalling was about to happen.
Johnson continued. Kirilo Budanov, chief of Ukraine's defense intelligence, said to Ukrainska Pravda that in late February, Russia had changed the date of the invasion several times. But on the 23rd of February, everything became clear.
The Russians kept postponing the date. For the last 2 weeks, they kept pushing it back and forth by a day or two. But on the 23rd, at around 2:30 p.m., it seems, we received clear information about how and when the invasion would take place. It was scheduled to commence at 4 in the morning. This information was passed to the president who gave the order. But just think about it. There wasn't much time left until 4 in the morning. I moved into my office full time and was already living there with my wife on the 23rd of February. We went to a grocery store in Petrivka, a neighborhood located in Kyivsobolonsky district, in the evening. I remember it well. We bought groceries there, my wife and I. We moved into my office, went to bed, talked and waited. Then I dozed off for a while. And the head of the office of the president of Ukraine called me at around 3:30 a.m. and said, well, it's already 3:30 and everything seems calm. Maybe it won't happen? I said, well, let's hope for the best, but I doubt it. And so we talked until almost 4 o'clock. You have to understand that this was also challenging for me, because if I, the head of the defense intelligence, had given an incorrect report, that wouldn't have reflected highly upon me. In the minds of the public, the first attacks happened at around 4:20 a.m., because that's when the first missiles launched actually arrived at their targets. That's it, I thought to myself, relieved in a way that it had actually started. Now I need to move past the fearful anticipation and start working on the next issue.
And there were many of these next issues at that moment. Many countries have never experienced such an onslaught of events in their history. The so-called world's second greatest army launched a full-scale military invasion along 2,000 kilometers of a shared border, which at one point turned into a front line. It was the largest front line in history since World War II. Ukraine, its people, its army, and its president had to switch instantly from thinking about whether there would be a war to addressing the most important question of all, how to survive and defend the country and the state.
On the morning of the 24th, you know, I woke up. I mean, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, maybe a bit earlier. I got a message from the national security advisor, one of my senior officials, and I was on a call with him and a couple of other senior guys, and who'd been with me to see Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv quite recently before then. And they said, Putin's invaded, and it started, it's happening. And I apparently said something terrible in English, which I won't repeat. I won't repeat on your sacred channel, but I allowed a profanity to pass my lips, as we say.
Boris Johnson remembers. He was one of the first to speak to Volodymyr Zelensky that morning and remembers exactly what Ukraine's partners were afraid of.
And then I talked to the president, Zelensky, a little bit later. And it was just he said they're invading on all sides. And he described what was happening in the east, in the north. And you've got to remember that at this stage, people really thought that Ukraine would not last very long.
The expectation that Ukraine had no chance of surviving Russia's invasion was not just an assumption by someone in the intelligence community. In February 2022, it was an unspoken conclusion drawn by Ukraine's friends in the West and its enemies in Moscow alike. Awareness of this assumption can explain a lot. It explains why Ukraine's partners limited their assistance to a rather symbolic level during the tensions before the invasion, and why Putin gave the operation the go-ahead, even though he really lacked the forces to take over such a huge country. But the Russian president didn't care. His main goal was not to capture or destroy Ukraine. In his sick imagination, this was just a means to an end. The main goal was different. A stunning blitzkrieg through Ukraine, with Russian troops reaching the borders of Moldova, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland that would instantly upend the geopolitical status quo in Europe. Putin's victorious army was meant to pave the way for its leader to rise to the heights of world domination, where he would once again, like Stalin, dictate his agenda to the entirety of the old world, at least. In the words of Putin's own war-themed address, Moscow wanted to make up for its losses in the Cold War and return the world to the state of affairs after the end of World War II.
The Soviet Union weakened in the late 1980s and then collapsed. We just lost confidence in ourselves for a while, and that was it. The balance of power in the world was disrupted. After the collapse of the USSR, the realignment of the world began, and the established norms of international law, the key basic ones adopted in the aftermath of World War II and largely consolidating its outcome, began to get in the way of the self-proclaimed winners of the Cold War.
Putin himself was so convinced of his own plans that he didn't even seem to consider that the overthrow of the government in Kyiv and the occupation of independent Ukraine would be a problem. On the contrary, he saw this almost as a fait accompli. That is why, in addition to talking about things like denazification, his address contains a few equally absurd appeals to the Ukrainian people, which can be summarized in two words: surrender and go home.
I am also addressing the citizens of Ukraine. Our actions are self-defense against the threats posed to us and against an even greater disaster than what is happening today. However difficult it may be, I ask you to understand this and call for cooperation in order to turn this tragic page as soon as possible and move forward together. I must also address the soldiers of the armed forces of Ukraine. You took an oath of allegiance to the Ukrainian people, not to the anti-national junta that plunders Ukraine and abuses its people. Do not follow its criminal orders. I urge you to lay down your weapons immediately and go home.
After all, what else would you expect an army to do in the face of an enemy invasion but march home? In the meantime, the Russian army crossed the border into Ukraine to implement its leader's crazy idea. In general, Putin's plan was impressive in its scale. At first, the large-scale missile and bomb attacks, with their unexpectedness, were supposed to completely destroy Ukraine's air defense systems and military aircraft. Having initially gained complete air superiority, Russian forces moved to the next stage: massive airborne landings at airports around Kyiv, the establishment of an air bridge where heavy transport aircraft would bring in attack groups and their equipment, and the move to capture the Ukrainian capital. Meanwhile, two enormous groups of soldiers were to march to Kyiv through Chernobyl and Chernihiv to ensure the capital's encirclement and capture. In the south, the Crimean strike group was to march across the isthmuses and, after dividing into western and eastern groups, capture the entire coastline of Ukraine. The eastern group, in parallel with the landings of the Black Sea Fleet along the coast, would advance through Kherson, Mykolaiv, and Odessa to Transnistria. The western group would go through Chonhar to Mariupol. After that, with simultaneous breakthroughs through Kharkiv and from the south, Russian troops were to meet near Dnipro and surround the most combat-capable forces of the armed forces of Ukraine, concentrated in Donbass, where Ukraine had already been fighting Russian occupiers via its joint forces operation. This plan seemed too far-fetched even for Putin. Boris Johnson recalls his skepticism about the inevitability of Russia's triumph in Ukraine.
And the military advice, so the military intelligence people were telling both me and our friends in Washington, the Americans, that Ukraine would not have the ability to hold out very long. But I want you to know something. I didn't think they were right, okay? Because I didn't understand how they could be right. Because I had been to Ukraine, and I knew it was a huge country full of Ukrainians. And I knew that the Ukrainians would not want to be conquered by the Russians, because I talked to them. And I was skeptical. But obviously I'm not a general, I'm not a tactician, I'm not a military man. And my instinct was that they'd made a mistake. And so I was very, very desperate to make sure that we got you guys everything that you needed as fast as possible.
On the morning of the 24th of February, Kyiv was the place that was most committed to not wanting to be conquered. It was quite obvious that no political goal was more important to Russia than the capital of Ukraine. It was Kyiv at which Putin's greatest focus was directed, not least because the euphemism special military operation was in fact accurate only for Kyiv.
Why did they call it a special military operation? Well, they didn't just coin the term on a whim. They never really planned for it to be a war, but rather an operation,
explains Kirilo Budanov, the head of Ukraine's intelligence.
The operation was to be as follows. No later than on the third day, they would enter the center of Kyiv and raise the flag above the presidential administration, the Verkhovna Rada, which is the Ukrainian parliament, and so on. And no later than the 10th day after that third day, that is, on the 13th or at worst on the 14th day, stamp out all organized resistance, if there was any. They weren't even certain that there would be. When people say that the Russians are stupid, they came without a supply of fuel, ammunition, food, or whatever, the fact is that they counted on the operation taking exactly 3 days, and they had everything they needed for that period. And we understood that. Our goal was to hinder the Russians as much as possible in the first 3 days and the subsequent 10. I said that if we endured for all 14 days, it would become easier, much easier.
But to hold out even 1 day was, without exaggeration, a feat. From the first minutes of the Great War, Kyiv and its surroundings were to become a first-run theater where Russia would showcase its full military might, working very expressive special effects into its premier screening in the form of missile attacks, large-scale landings, and rapid armored breakthroughs. According to the Kremlin's plan, the seizure of Ukrainian land was to begin with the conquest of the skies. The first missile strikes were supposed to destroy the air defense system instantly and wipe out the entirety of Ukraine's military aviation infrastructure. If this had succeeded, the Russian army would have gained complete air superiority. And from the very first minutes of the invasion, Kremlin propaganda indeed proclaimed that Ukrainian air defenses had ceased to exist.
That was why, on the morning of the 24th, a group of Russian Mil-Mi-35 helicopters carrying elite troops of the Russian landing force calmly flew into the territory of Ukraine from Belarus and over the Dnipro River, with the aim of seizing the airfield in Hostomel. How surprised must they have been when Ukrainian defenders opened fire on them at the beginning of their journey, forcing one Mi-35 to switch to submarine mode and make an emergency landing in the water, and another to make an emergency landing near the forest. When Ukrainian combat aircraft appeared, the Russian paratroopers probably finally understood that not everything their Ministry of Defense tells them should be taken at face value. The Ukrainian command already knew that Hostomel was a bottleneck that could make or break the invasion plans.
What destroyed them was that we had a copy of their plan, and so all hopes of surprise action were shattered on that first day when they couldn't land any planes,
explains Budanov.
Believe me, if they had landed the airlifted component that was in the air, the planes, they would have succeeded here. Their plans were destroyed by our knowledge that the heart, the key to their operation, lay in Hostomel.
So the main thing was...
But the main thing was to disrupt the airborne operation, because we knew all their plans. On the 23rd, one of our special purpose groups, which had previously conducted reconnaissance in Hostomel, arrived here, the Defense Intelligence of Ukraine, and as soon as the first rockets were fired, they immediately advanced to the airfield. The task was clearly outlined for them, to delay Russia as much as possible, to make the landing of airborne units impossible, and they succeeded. They bought us time, enough time for the first unit of the regular Ukrainian army to arrive, deploy artillery, and have the airfield under direct control within their firing range. As you now all know, the task was accomplished. Not a single military transport plane ever landed.
As various sources have said, about 20 Russian Ilyushin Il-76 transport aircraft with landing forces and equipment were already circling over the Russian town of Pskov. However, Putin's generals didn't dare to give the order to head for Ukrainian airspace. This was thanks to the fact that the 4th Brigade of the National Guard of Ukraine, which was based in Hostomel together with other defense forces, managed to first deter the Russian landing force from arriving at the airfield and then bombard the runway with their artillery. Later, Russian reinforcements would allow the armed forces of the Russian Federation to seize the airfield in Hostomel. But it was no longer usable as one, turning solely into a graveyard for Russian equipment and personnel. The only victory by the Russians would be the destruction of the unique Ukrainian aircraft, the Antonov 225 Maria, which the pilots did not have time to move from the airfield hangar. Despite this, the defenders of Hostomel fulfilled their key mission. They prevented the Russians from quickly building up their strike forces for the attack on Kyiv and gave the capital time to organize its defense.
The Russians became victims of their own propaganda,
says Taras Chmut, head of the Come Back Alive charitable foundation.
They did everything by the book as far as their operation was concerned, capturing airfields, then landing troops and supplies from the air, organizing a build-up and so on. They didn't take into account the fact that we wouldn't just fall apart. They didn't expect total resistance. They didn't expect the first strike, the main strike, not to destroy all of our air defenses. If they had gained full control of the air, things would have been much worse.
You could see how much worse it could have been in the first few days of fighting in Borodyanka, where Russian bombers flew in and where whole streets of high-rise buildings were turned into ruins.
They did not destroy the air defense system. Yes, there were losses, some people and some equipment, but they were really small considering what could have happened. The air defense system started working from day one. They didn't expect our air defenses to be as good as they were. The equipment is Soviet-made and old, but still effective. Both the old Buk and S-300 anti-aircraft missile systems worked as intended,
explains Chmut. It is simply impossible to overstate the importance of the fact that Hostomel didn't become one end of a Russian air bridge and that the Ukrainian air defense system survived. Russian forces, instead of quickly flying into Ukraine, were forced to charge towards Kyiv in long convoys through the thick Polesian forests, and to make matters worse, without the umbrella of air superiority, General Oleksandr Sirsky, who at the time was responsible for the defense of Kyiv, recalls several curious military moments of the Russian advance caused by their haste.
They thought that this issue would be resolved in 3 days, and then it would just be a matter of bringing in more troops to operate equipment. The convoys were 50, 70, or even 100 units long. They started up, were guided by a limited number of crews and calculations, and proceeded without air cover. We saw how our Bayraktar drones destroyed books. At first, we couldn't understand how a Bayraktar could get right up close to a convoy and take out a book, which could shoot them down from 20 kilometers away. It turned out that nobody had even prepared to take out frets on the move. In fact, nobody was even manning the systems. It was just commanders and mechanics tasked with transporting this equipment. That was their main mistake.
The defense for which General Sirsky was responsible was not, to put it mildly, fully ready on the morning of the 24th. On one hand, as Sirsky said, the decision to create a Kyiv defense headquarters was made a week before the start of the invasion.
We began to prepare. Time was limited. At that time, no one wanted to believe it. They wanted to believe that there wouldn't be an invasion after all. But the process was set in motion, and we began to prepare. We identified the elements of the plan, carried out preparatory measures, decided on the troops, and conducted reconnaissance. The day before the invasion, I gathered all the leaders of the security sector who had the strength and means and, according to the plan, were included in the defense of Kyiv. We gathered the leadership of the city and explained the purpose of this defense operation. The operation was organized, and all the heads of the sectors that had been created were introduced.
On the other hand, if we take into account the shortage of military forces that Kyiv faced, the city, although not as vulnerable as the Russians had assumed, didn't seem fully protected. General Sirsky recalls,
"It was a daunting task. First, the city was completely unprepared. Second, there were no forces or resources to defend such a city and such an agglomeration. The 72nd Brigade, which formed the basis of the group for the defense of Kyiv, was assigned there in the final few days. At the same time, this brigade was not enough. It covered only one quarter of our needs, the minimum needs for defense. Therefore, I decided to create rifle battalions and consolidated artillery units out of students enrolled in military academies, consolidated units of the Petro-Sahaidachny National Ground Forces Academy were involved, as was the Zhytomyr Institute, which formed two battalions. We began to involve the National Guard, which was stationed in Kyiv, and police units, and the Territorial Defense Force, which was being formed and which was supposed to ensure the formation of the inner ring of defense."
Andriy Malinovsky, the head of the Rocket Forces and Artillery Department of the Ground Forces Training Command, recalls that on the 22nd of February, an order was given to move joint military units and artillery closer to Kyiv. On the day of the invasion, troops were on the march. The big problem was that there was practically no artillery in Kyiv. Most of the forces were concentrated in the east. The fate of Kyiv was in the hands of one division of 2S7 Pion self-propelled artillery, which essentially ended up in the city by chance. Major General Malinovsky recalls,
"The consolidated artillery for general support began to defend Kyiv. It was part of one division of the 43rd Artillery Brigade, consolidated because the main forces of this division were in the east of the country. And unfortunately, there was a lot of faulty equipment in the brigade at the time, which remained at the permanent deployment point and was being repaired on-site and at the Shepetivka plant. The main non-standard solution was as follows in our country. The Interdepartmental Center for Rocket Forces and Artillery had a so-called D-30 salute battery consisting of 12 guns. D-30 was not a combat unit. During preparations for the operation, we suggested to the commander that he create a combined division armed with these D-30 guns. The division commander was Colonel Alexander Shiroki. With the help of his instructors, instructional staff, conscripts, and contractors, we created consolidated services and had a general support division equipped with D-30 guns.
The initial advantage that the Ukrainian armed forces had was partly due to the fact that the Russians had not had time to set up their own artillery. It was still in convoys moving south from Belarus. Malinovsky recalls,
"There was no enemy artillery fire against us at that time. Artillery assets were distributed in this way not only to Hostomel, but to various sites, and so one division solved practically all the issues. The D-30 and a consolidated 2S-7, with these forces, which started a defense operation of Kyiv. Then the commander-in-chief made a decision about the distribution of artillery assets. We were reinforced with an Uragan Hurricane rocket battery, but that was later. At the beginning, we had a D-30 division, a 2S-7 battery, and the artillery of the 72nd Brigade.
Once the Russian artillery reached the outskirts of Kyiv, things got tougher. As expected, Russia had orders of magnitude more artillery at its disposal than Ukraine, though the Russians had issues with accuracy.
I'm grateful to God that their artillery forces didn't seem to be able to aim particularly well. It's not that they were slightly off, they were off by a lot. They had trouble determining our coordinates, where our artillery systems were, and where our forces were. That worked to our advantage, despite the fact that our unit was cobbled together from several others. The guys worked well together.
While the line of defense was being constructed around Kyiv, the residents of the capital were getting to grips with the fact that the war had begun, as were people all over Ukraine. Every minute brought more news, and it was hard to know what was true and what wasn't. Did Russian Navy forces land in Odessa or Russian air assault troops in Lviv? Lviv Mayor Andriy Sadovyi recalls,
"That was when we got a report that a Russian landing force had arrived in one of Lviv Oblast's districts. I got the report, so I shared it. It caused mass hysteria. Everyone who had any strength started calling district administrations, joining volunteer forces. Everyone started making Bandera smoothies."
A Bandera smoothie is another term for a Molotov cocktail, which gets its name from the improvised weapons used by the Finns to defend themselves in the war against them in 1939-1940 under Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov. Stepan Bandera, in contrast, was a Ukrainian nationalist activist and politician.
"There were boxes of Bandera smoothies in almost every household. I started to worry, dear God, what if something happens and all this stuff blows up? The whole city was armed with whatever people had in their homes, shotguns, rifles, and ready to shoot at Russian tanks if they came from their windows to throw Bandera smoothies at them."
Not only did everyone in Ukraine want to help the Ukrainian forces, but many people also rushed to uncover Russian agents and collaborators, seeing Russian sabotage and reconnaissance groups everywhere, in street graffiti, suspicious individuals, unfamiliar cars, or a strange pink light in someone's window. Serhiy Cherevaty, spokesman for the Eastern Group of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, told Ukrainska Pravda that the Russians took advantage of the people's panic once they noticed it, but it wasn't part of their original brilliant plan.
"Unfortunately, it's normal for that to happen at the beginning of a war, any war, when people are trying to figure out who is us and who is them, to get used to what the war entails, and the large numbers of uniformed people. Well, the fear of Russian sabotage and reconnaissance groups is part of that. Territorial Defense Forces, TRO, were being recruited before people's eyes. People who'd never served before were joining. We didn't just have the TRO, whose members actually did have some sort of military training, but also volunteer units of territorial Hromadas, DFTG, groups of volunteers. We needed lots of them, even for the purposes of the information war. They were very effective. We pushed the narrative that the Russians will be met with a torrent of fire, with grandmas waiting for them with axes and women with Molotov cocktails wherever possible. Naturally, there were some saboteurs and collaborators. All we had to do was clarify things, and our colleagues in the security service of Ukraine did their jobs, and we worked closely with the police. This situation of confusion didn't last very long. In relation to the duration of the war, it was resolved quite quickly. But this is true even of the most advanced armies. There is an adaptation to new conditions, and we had many of these challenges. The TRO, the distribution of weapons, and some people wearing the wrong uniforms. That's why we had to create passwords, security codes, and a system of checkpoints. In fact, even in the early days of the TRO, everyone was afraid of it.
Taras Chmut recalls,
back then, getting from Ivano-Frankivsk to Kiev took 2 days and 1,038 checkpoints, including 4 where you'd be shot at, 8 where you'd be pinned down on the ground, and 24 where they'd take something from you. We developed a good relationship with the police patrols. They accompanied our cars when we went from Ivano-Frankivsk to other oblasts. We still got shot at when entering Kiev. Our driver got really lucky, though, and wasn't hurt, so that's good. This happened to us on a few more occasions in Kyiv. On the second or third night, we were on a TRO mission and were shot at by Ukrainian forces. We decided never to go anywhere at night from then on.
The Pretula Foundation faced similar issues. No one shot at their cars, but their drivers were frequently detained at checkpoints.
Ми намагалися налагодити нашу логістику навколо Києва, розвозити допомогу.
We were trying to iron out our logistics in and around Kyiv to centralize aid distribution. It was rather tricky. Every day the guys leading the convoys would be pinned down and searched. We had a funny incident when the guys from Ukraine's security service asked us to use our drones to help them gather some intelligence. Everyone's resources were stretched at the time, but we had experienced drone operators. They went to launch the drone and were met quite violently by a territorial volunteer unit. I was given the phone number for that group. I texted and called them. No response. I recorded a video. Dear call sign Liutyi, the Ukrainian word for furious. I am sincerely grateful for your vigilance. You have to say you're grateful before asking for something. But please let them go. Something like that would happen dozens of times every single day.
Sometimes incidents like that were rather less comical, with numerous shootings resulting from someone mistaking a friend for a foe.
This happened in Kyiv's Oblansky district in late February 2022.
Dmytro, an officer and a military psychologist, recalls.
A truck carrying Ukrainian soldiers approached a checkpoint from Hostomel. The driver missed the narrow passage between concrete blocks and skidded a little. A TRO fighter opened fire without warning. One of the soldiers who was in the truck was killed. Another had his leg injured. I was a combat medic at the time and treated the injured soldier. Even back then, I knew that it was unlikely that a truck full of orcs, a slang term for Russian soldiers, would just enter Kyiv and drive around. It was fear that made all those people who were holding weapons in their hands for the first time do things like that. Hysteria in the information space made them see saboteurs everywhere.
During the first days of the full-scale invasion, communication failed even between units who were in the same area. Taras Chmut recalls,
another issue that came up at the time was that coordination among the military was faltering. Sometimes we had to create group chats and messenger apps to introduce two battalion commanders who ended up in the same area.
Ukraine's Defense Intelligence Chief Kirilo Budanov stresses that there was a real threat of sabotage and reconnaissance groups, and the tough measures in the first hours and days of the full-scale invasion helped inhibit them.
Були прийняті дуже жорсткі форми і методи роботи.
I know these were tough measures, but they worked. They curbed the activity of any sabotage groups. Yes, sometimes innocent people would get caught up in this, but they would eventually be able to go back to their lives. But these strict measures made it impossible for sabotage groups to operate. We knew the outlines of the plan, we knew the broad strokes, let's put it that way. The security service had some information at their disposal, and so did the National Police and the Ministry of Internal Affairs. They had a lot. Strict security was adopted from the first days, you might recall. Remember when, at countless checkpoints, patrols would inspect anyone that looked suspicious and so on? Whether they had the official right to do so or not, at the time this was justified and considered the right thing to do.
Another aspect of Ukrainian resistance Putin couldn't foresee was the spirit of unity. The Russian dictator knew that his army would face the Ukrainian army, but instead it was met with the resistance of the entire Ukrainian people. The volunteer movement, which has been growing since 2014, is probably the best example of this grassroots resistance. There are no parallels to the transformation it underwent on the 24th of February 2022. Ukrainian volunteer Serhii Pritula recalls,
I was volunteering as an individual before the full-scale invasion. The foundation, which was registered in July 2020, operated as a non-military aid organization. I raised around 52 million hryvnias, approximately $1.4 million, over the 8 years before the full-scale invasion. In 8 years, I think I raised about the same amount as on the first day of the full-scale invasion, and my bank card was blocked. It wasn't the Ukrainian Privat Bank that blocked it, though it was also shocked by what happened. Their system wasn't prepared for individuals, even volunteers, to receive so much money in their account so rapidly. The card was blocked by Visa or MasterCard. And I was just overjoyed because people were donating and everyone was writing to me. It was madness. The payment did not go through. I use online banking on my phone, and it was just a constant stream of notifications of failed payments. So we quickly transitioned the fund from a humanitarian to a military one. What's the point of comparing? We've raised 52 million hryvnias over the past 8 years, and now 4.1 billion hryvnias, approximately $107.3 million, over just this past year.
Taras Chmut, a fellow volunteer, says in a somewhat ironic tone that this was the time when you could ask for and receive anything on Twitter.
On the 24th of February, we bought pretty much every drone in Kyiv. We started buying everything we could get our hands on and bringing it to the office. We've had lots of people come in, talk to us about stuff, help with stuff. So you post on Twitter, we need $1 million, and you get $1 million. You say, I need a helicopter, and you get a helicopter.
There were two types of people, those who had something or had ways of securing access to it, and those who needed those things, vast quantities of them. The morning of the 24th of February turned the offices of the Pritula Foundation into one enormous conveyor belt for volunteers.
You have to understand, we'd have 600 to 800, even up to 1,000 military personnel come to us every day. It was like a river that wouldn't dry up. People would come in, then they'd leave and new people would come, vehicles would come and go, and everything we could get each day would be gone that very same day. It didn't matter what it was. Everything from sleeping bags to Kevlar helmets, from medicine kits to multi-packs of water, everything would be gone. There were even some people working for the foundation who were part of what we used to call the "they're gonna fucking hit us" sect. They used to say, if I was a Russian military analyst in front of a screen watching hundreds and hundreds of military personnel coming to the same spot in Kyiv each day, and it's easy to figure that out, I'd hit that place with a missile. At times, all of this wasn't much fun at all. Communication failures in the military resulted in conflicts with us. At one point, when a car full of armed men, dissatisfied with what they thought was the foundation's failure to help their unit, showed up at our offices, it was just no longer funny.
They were from a famous unit, a combat unit, a really heroic one. When five men with guns show up at your office, all in a very sour mood, you start to get a bit tense. But then we laid out before those guys, word for word, all the transfer and acceptance certificates for their unit. They scanned the surnames of people on the receiving end and verified that, yes, they were all from their unit. They apologized, we embraced, the guys went off to fight, and we sighed, okay, no friendly fire today, I guess.
Taras Chamut says that to avoid more situations like that, the Comeback Alive Foundation made a decision on the very first day of the full-scale invasion to stop operating as an open foundation.
We made three strategic decisions at the time. First, we decided that we were not an open foundation, so don't come to us, we're not handing things out, we're not waiting for you. We will seek out those whom we should help, taking into account what's needed so as not to lose the war. For us, that was all about Chernihiv and Kyiv. Kyiv will stand so long as Chernihiv stands. As long as Kyiv stands, Ukraine keeps fighting. If Kyiv falls, the president wouldn't leave Kyiv. The commander-in-chief certainly wouldn't leave Kyiv. So if Kyiv fell, I think everything else would crumble. So we focused on the defense forces in the north, in Chernihiv. Chernihiv was encircled. We had to break through enemy lines to get there. Each time we managed, we'd send as much as we could to the soldiers there.
This is how Ukrainian forces defended Kyiv. Tune in to the next episode to hear about what was happening in Chernihiv, the defense of Kharkiv, and why Russian forces were able to break through the Ukrainian defenses in southern Ukraine. You've been listening to the third episode of 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, a podcast by Ukrainska Pravda. Please rate and leave comments under this podcast. It will help it to break through the filters to the widest audience possible. Consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or via RSS on Captivate.fm.
To be continued.